Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you so much, Audrey. You did it again. And here we are in 2213. It's a brand new, wait a minute, it's not 2213, it's 2013, Mike, come on, get the calendar right on the show, we can do that, can't we? Thank you so much, Audrey, Mike, and Emily, very much for helping us get all this stuff going. It's hard to get it all together, I'm telling you, there's so much electronics involved in this now, you almost have to be some kind of computer expert, but Blog Talk Radio makes it as easy as you can do it. And just remember, if you want to get your own show, probably 3 minutes, you could be signed up and broadcasting worldwide. So try it sometime if you got nothing else to do. What we tried to do on this show, called Jumble Justice, is discuss news issues, events, and developments in this interesting field, difficult field, and sometimes humorous field of criminal justice. Johnny Cash, I always stop his show, or his introductory song, I've Been Everywhere Man, when he gets to Dayton, Ohio. I was in Dayton, Ohio, having lunch on Sunday, north of Dayton, actually, but in the same area, having lunch with an old police friend. And so we're sitting in a restaurant, and guess what happened? Good old, I love that area there. The Rite Aid store was robbed. The guy came in and robbed the Rite Aid store. They eventually caught him. He tried to rob another one around Nucala, Ohio, I think, or something like that. But good place to have your concealed carry. What a topic to study, concealed carry and guns and all this business. And we'll get our fill of that and overfill on that tonight, because that's what our show is going to be about. But we dedicate this show to these police officials and corrections and court officials and juvenile justice professionals who respond to these needs that we have in providing a safe society for all of us. It's a hard job, especially during these holiday times. They have to work extra hours oftentimes, and they get strange calls and on and on and on and on. So, hey, but they do get paid for it. They have a retirement system, and they're very fortunate to have a job. And believe me, it is a professional service. It's hard work, working in any aspect of criminal justice, and they do a wonderful job. We have high crime rates in many places in the United States. We'll talk about Chicago a little bit later. Remember, Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, wants you to tweet him and tell him what to do about the homicides that he's having in that city. Okay, Blog Talk Radio. Remember, any person, interest group, or group can have their own show literally in a few minutes, and they can broadcast every week of their life, every day, etc. What the limit is now, Mike, do you know? I actually don't know. I will have to check into that, but we want to thank Al Levy for providing this wonderful, brilliant, innovative system of having a radio show. You can get your own show. Tonight, if you want to call in during the news show, during the news segment, you could probably call in at 347-996-5983. We've got a really interesting presenter to listen to tonight. And, well, let me tell you a little bit about him right now. It's Craig Whitney, and he is the author of the book, Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment. And very interesting gentleman. He's been a New York Times foreign correspondent. He was later an editor for the newspaper, and then he retired, I think, in 2009. And this book is out, and it's going to be a little bit different because, as they said, you wouldn't think a liberal would make a strong case for Second Amendment rights. Some do, and this is certainly an exception, and he's going to do that tonight. I think you will enjoy it. Well, Audrey, Emily, Lucy, none of them have a blonde joke tonight, so I've got one. So I'm going to play the blonde joke, and I'm going to use an automated voice. I was going to give her an Italian name, like Saito Automaci. In other words, say it in automatic voice. But I'll just go ahead and play this blonde joke for you tonight. It's an interesting one, so let's go ahead and listen to it.
A blonde was shopping at Kmart and came across a shiny silver thermos. She was quite fascinated by it, so she picked it up and took it over to the clerk to ask what it was. The clerk said, "Why, that's a thermos. It keeps hot things hot and cold things cold." "Well," said the blonde, "that's amazing. I'm going to buy it." So she took the thermos and took it to work the next day. Her boss, who is also blonde, saw it on her desk. "What's that?" he asked. "Why, that's a thermos. It keeps hot things hot and cold things cold," she replied. "What do you have in it?" asked the boss. "Two popsicles and some coffee."
Internet must be clogged up a little bit tonight. People still vacationing and Facebooking and tweeting and all kinds of things. And they got stuff going on there now I don't even want to know about on the internet. Unbelievable. Well, that's a fine blonde joke. And actually, I think we've heard that one before. We're to the point where it's hard to find original blonde jokes, but I know how to do it, so we'll do it the next time. Ladies and gentlemen, since we're talking about guns and gun violence tonight and the potential to reduce it and let law-abiding citizens adhere to the Second Amendment and have firearms that they both deserve and warrant as citizens of the United States, we're going to have the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms play their public service announcement that's geared toward criminals, I'm sure, so that they will turn in their firearms when they hear this message.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition, as we always do. It's a pleasure to have you give us that message. And I just wonder if we could ever do the research to see how many criminals hear that message and then go turn their guns in and give it up as a criminal life. All right, let's have a green tip for tonight. This one, I don't mean to be morbid with this green tip, but I thought it was a good one. We're going to take this tip from a place we never take a green tip from. Oh, yes, we do. It's Esma Floyd's little book, 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. And this is the green joke for tonight. Please don't let it affect your disposition. Go the green way, it says. Go the green way. Make your Stop laughing, Mike. Make your last action on Earth a green one by choosing an eco burial. Many localities now have forest burial sites where a tree is planted on each plot. I never thought of that. So make your last action on Earth a green one. Choose an eco burial site. So remember that one, Mike. Jot that down. That's an interesting one. That one almost deserves a pause, but we'll reserve that because it's a very serious moment. So think about that. Okay, let's look at some criminal justice news. And boy, there's some good stuff going on tonight. Some of it's sane and some of it is not so sane. Let's go ahead and take a look at some of these things. Isn't that nice? Oh, there it goes. Evernote was thinking. I don't know if you folks ever use Evernote, but it allows you to store millions and millions of records and documents and files and play them in audio or make audio notes in them, mark them up of different colors and all kinds of stuff. And I'm working on the surveillance book, and I've archived probably 150 articles there. I don't even make a inch on my current monthly usage screen. So then you can create as many notebooks as you want, which is good. But anyway, here's the first story for tonight. The number of FBI background checks required for Americans buying guns set a record in December, in other words, December 2012, indicating that more people may purchase one after the Connecticut school massacre stirred interest in self-defense and prompted renewed talk about limits on firearms. The FBI said it recorded 2.78 million background checks during the month of December, surpassing the mark set in November of 2000.01 million checks, about a 39% rise. So that is just incredible. The last monthly figure was up 49% over December 2011, when the FBI performed a then record check of 1.86 million checks. But isn't that incredible? December's probably the busiest month, of course, because people want Christmas presents for folks, and some ask for guns, and some are surprised when they get a firearm. So they did that. But for FBI checks for all of 2012 totaled 19.6 million. And we know there's 200 million guns plus in the country. Some would say as many as 300 million. I doubt that, but who really knows? But they think the Sandy Hook Elementary terrible tragedy where the children and teachers were killed caused this, and are afraid that new regulations will come along and restrict the use of guns. I heard that somebody told me that Walmart sold out of firearms during December. Could that be true? Perhaps it did. Actually, I didn't even know Walmart sold firearms, to be honest. I thought they sold those black powder things that don't have a lot of regulations around it. But anyway, that's what happened. I thought this was interesting. I'm always interested in the drone business, as people who listen to the show know. It says here a federal judge has ruled that President Barack Obama's administration doesn't have to publicly disclose its legal justification for the drone attacks and other methods it uses to kill terrorism suspects overseas. New York Times and the ACLU had filed suit in 2011 under the Freedom of Information Act to have these documents brought forward. The judge, Colleen McMahon, chided the Obama administration for refusing to provide the documents but said she had no authority to order them disclosed. She says she finds herself in a paradoxical situation, which I cannot solve a problem because of the contradictory constraints and rules. So it's a check 22 for her. So catch 22, excuse me. Catch, how do you spell check? Catch. She said that more fulsome disclosure of the legal reasoning on which the administration relies to justify the targeted killings of individuals, including United States citizens, far from any recognizable hot field of battle, would allow for more intelligent discussion and assessment of a tactic like torture before it,
remains hotly debated, the judge wrote. I think she's right on the money about that. And we've had a show about drones, and we talked about the book Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, written by Medea Benjamin. And I would highly recommend that well-documented book with hundreds of footnotes. Most people have no idea what to do. Okay, think talking about academic researchers with nothing to do. I'm kidding, but the caption for this news article is, "Inept cops and irredeemable criminals are standard fare in superhero cartoons, a sociologist finds." She asks whether this is a good thing or not. Lisa Courts Butler says cartoons abandon ideals such as rehabilitation. The sociologist suggests parents encourage children to think beyond cartoons. And she published this in Criminal Justice Review, which is a good, very reputable journal. And she looked at shows like Batman, Spider-Man, what else did she look at? Something else. And says, what we see reflected in the media, including superhero cartoons, is a portrayal of criminals as others, as bad or evil, and as sometimes irredeemable, says Court Butler, the sociologist. By email, the logical consequence is to keep those kind of people locked away from the rest of us and to abandon ideals such as rehabilitation. When I watch a murder mystery, an old film on Turner Movie Classics, and it's about gangsters or something like that, I never care at the end of the show whether they get rehabilitated or not. Do you? But she's saying this is awful for our children because children draw conclusions from these cartoons and these superhero events, and it gives them the idea that these people who go out and shoot and beat up and break into people's homes and steal items of high value aren't worth anything. Of course, some of them are. I know some of them have been 100% rehabilitated. But on the other hand, sociology, you've heard that definition, right? Everything you always knew in terms you've never heard before. So this finding, we may be running out of things to study in sociology, but we're studying the cartoons and how they have an impact on children and their reflections on or positions on rehabilitation. Wow. Remember the newspaper up in New York that Newtown published after the Newtown, Connecticut massacre, published the names and addresses of legal gun owners? And you can get that map. It's the Journal News. You can get that map that showed gun owners in Westchester and Rockland counties in New York. And it showed what they were. I think it gave their names, and maybe, I don't know if it told the kind of guns, but you look at that map, it's dotted all over the place. And then everybody said, oh, this is terrible. You know, they're making it dangerous for these people who have guns. Now everybody knows that the people I think they're making it dangerous for are the people on the map, home addresses that don't have guns, because the criminals, some of them have brains, some don't. They're going to look at this and say, I'm not going to break into that place. This guy's got, you know, two shotguns or whatever. I think I'll skip that one and go to this house over here where they say they don't have any guns. Well, anyway, apparently the newspaper's been getting threats. And so now the newspaper, who's strongly against guns, has now done what? They now hired armed guards armed with guns, not bean shooters, and nightsticks, to protect their building and their people in West Nyack, New York. They won't comment on what the nature of the threats are, but apparently they've been threatened and now they're resorting to guns to do this. Here's a good idea. When your prisons are empty, why don't you turn it into a tourism site? Can you believe in Jefferson City, Missouri, tours of the old Mississippi State Penitentiary in Jefferson City turned a profit last year for the first time, and tourism officials think that's only the beginning. More than 19,000 people from 23 countries visited the former prison. Now, these are visitors, not prisoners, but it's sent from foreign countries, generating $275,000 in revenue, roughly $35,000 of which was profit, the Jefferson City News reported. They expect more growth. They're going to do a couple more things. this prison is kind of famous. It had Sonny Liston, Pretty Boy Floyd in there. James Earl Ray had escaped from this prison when he assassinated civil rights leader Martin Luther Jr. King Jr. in 1968. The prison was the site of a riot in 1954 that killed four inmates and injured 50 others. Four prison workers were also injured in that thing. So anyway, if you can't fill the prisons up, which I can't understand why we can't, I don't think crime has disappeared, you can use it as a tourism site. Why don't they let you stay over in the prison? That'd be a new idea. You know, you got empty cells, why not rent them out? See what people think, experience the prison experience. Let them stay there. That could be a good idea. All right, let's end here with, well, I don't want to end with this, but Chicago. In 2012, 532 people were murdered in the city. Now, that's murdered. That's not talking about shooting. Not everybody died. Before that, the murder rate was 441. That was their record. So murders have increased by 91 from 2011 to 2012. And Mayor Rahm Emanuel says the police department's doing all they can do. I heard some other commentator who wasn't the most astute on criminal justice facts say, well, this was all the drug trade doing this. Well, I think he's got to pay attention to convenience store robberies and some other things and people being mugged on the street and shot. It's not all the drug trade. And I think they could take a lesson, as some have suggested. I heard someone say it just recently on television, that they ought to take a lesson from New York. And what New York did is they went out and got the gun criminals, entered their homes at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning with a probation officer who had the right to enter the home. They need a search warrant. Locked them up, took their guns away from them, kept them in prison for a long period of time, and they had a remarkable drop in homicides in the city of New York. And they went from, you've heard me say it before, 2,200 like in 1990 down to over 400, 500 or something here recently. So there is an answer to this. Well, is anybody planning a pot trip to Denver or some other part of Colorado? They legalized a pot, and with reggae music pumping in the background and flashing disco-style lights, members of the Recreational Pot Club lit up in celebration of the new year and a new place to smoke legally among friends. This is called Club 64. That name comes from the name of the law, or the number of the law, that the Colorado governor signed into place. And guess what? This pot club is going to move around. In other words, they're not just going to let you smoke pot in one location. They're going to go to other places. And this is a recreational pot club. Corey said private pot dens are permissible because marijuana isn't sold nor is food or drink. So you can have a private place where you can come and smoke. They charge you $29.99 to get in, the admission price, and you have to bring your own pot to the Bring Your Own Pot Club. So we'll have to see how that, I imagine we're going to have people capitalize on this. They're going to go on tours. They're going to have a bar decorated with blue Christmas lights, handed out sodas and Club 64's official snacks, Goldfish and Cheetos. The snacks were inspired by Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, who warned marijuana users the night of the marijuana vote, don't break out the Cheetos or Goldfish too quickly. So they decided to take up on that, and that's what they're serving is Cheetos and Goldfish, and you bring your own pot. Absolutely remarkable. We'll have to see how that turns out. You think there'll be world pot tours to Colorado to see how this thing goes? Of course, keep in mind, this is in conflict with federal law. Federal law says you can't, a number of ways, you can't do this. So it's going to be interesting to see how this thing actually works. Well, let's take a listen to the presentation of Craig Whitney. Talk about his book, Living with Guns, A Liberal's Case for the Second Amendment. He's interviewed by Paul Helmke. He's former president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. This is kind of interesting because you're now talking about a guy that over time has done research, and he's changed his mind about certain contact gun restrictions and doing away with the Second Amendment and that type of thing. So hold on just a second. Here we go.
Craig Whitney, you've worked for the New York Times, you've been a bureau chief and reporter around the world, you're an organist, a specialist, you've written a book on organ music. Living with guns, how did you come to this topic?
Well, precisely because I had lived abroad for so many years, I would often be asked by friends in those countries, what is it with the United States and Americans and guns? Why do you have such a love affair with guns, is the way some of them would sometimes put it. And I'd do my best to explain, but I realized that I didn't really know myself, so I thought when I retired, when I had time, I would try to do some research and find out why do we have the Second Amendment and how has it been understood during all the years it's been in force. And the book was a result.
It read the book with interest. You cover a lot of the history. You cover the legal battles. You cover what's going on current day. Let's go through a lot of that. And starting with the history, what surprised you the most when you looked at American history and saw the role that guns played or didn't play in?
Well, I grew up in Massachusetts in the 50s, and of course we always made a big thing of Thanksgiving and Massasoit and Squanto and so on. And the kind of the way the story ran in schools when we learned about it was the Pilgrims came and they were very friendly with the Indians and they celebrated the first Thanksgiving and, you know, everything was hunky-dory. Well, you read the history of even the colonies in Massachusetts and you find that relations between Native Americans and the new English settlers who came in were anything but friendly much of the time. And you had massacres on both sides and tremendous hostility, understandable because the Native Americans thought the land belonged to them, and lo and behold, the
immigrants came to their way.
But that is certainly what surprised me. Now, I know there have been some questions raised by other historians about whether the colonists really had as many guns as people nowadays say they did, but you look back at the history and you find that guns were very important. If you were a white male over the age of 18, you were practically required to have a firearm and to produce it when called upon to defend your town or community or state.
The tradition that came from Britain or just any place overseas or just anybody that was going to take the risk of crossing the ocean?
There was a common law right in England, too, that allowed people to have firearms for self-defense and other purposes. And that right, common law right, traveled across the ocean with the colonists, and they needed the guns here, whereas in England, mostly, they didn't. People soon came to have an enormous facility and knowledge of firearms, and of course, as we all know, it produced the result of victory against the most powerful military country in the world at the time in the Revolutionary War.
I want to talk about that a little bit. And again, I think people get hazy views on history, and it comes from movies or TV a lot of the time. When we had the Revolutionary period, what was the role of guns in these militias or these requirements that we talked about?
Well, George Washington didn't think a whole lot of the militia. He groused about it at times. But he also had made some remarks that allowed us how the militia was a useful thing to have. It couldn't have built the Continental Army without the existence of the militias and people who had been in militias. And more importantly, of volunteers and others who knew how to use firearms, and that was key.
So if you people were using these on the frontier, protection against the Indians, Native Americans, hunting certainly, and then during in the colonies, some sense of responsibility for the common good. And,
exactly. The right, the common law right to have and use firearms came with a civic duty to use them when called upon.
Who was in charge of these militias? I mean,
local commanders, towns, very often had them in New England, certainly. Later on, they became more broadly based. But as tensions and hostilities mounted between the British authorities and the colonists in the approach to the Revolutionary War, it was seen by many of the leaders at the time as an advantage that we Americans knew how to use firearms.
At this time, was there organized law enforcement in these communities, or was in effect this group of volunteers or militia, was that the law enforcement?
It depends on the size of the town, but there weren't armed policemen running around in places like Boston and Philadelphia, but sure, there were. It was mostly locally based, as I understand it. I'm not the world's greatest expert on pre-revolutionary history, but it was. There certainly was a sense of duty to serve in a militia when you were called upon.
And I know in American history, the shots that rang around the world, Lexington and Concord, April 18th to 75. Everybody knows a little bit about that, but. One thing, and your book touches on this just a little bit, but it's still a little confusing historically to me. The British were actually marching on the armory because a lot of the guns and the ammunition, I assume, were stored at the armory, in effect, a communal place for the guns and the ammunition. They were marching there, and that's what Paul Revere went to warn folks about, wasn't
right.
it?
And the Minutemen came out and tried to resist them, and did successfully.
But what if, in my mind, the armory sort of talks about how this is a common usage, common purpose, which I know isn't necessarily what you did with
right.
you.
It's not necessarily a contradiction. For instance, if you didn't have a gun and you should have had one according to the militia requirements in one of these towns, the town would sometimes provide it to you. They would then bill you for it. So in a sense, it was private property even if they assigned you the weapon. But sure, they, being militias, they needed to keep a supply of firearms and ammunition for those occasions when lots of force was needed to deal with an Indian attack or whatever it was. And so they did have storage facilities in armories.
But even back then, there were restrictions and regulations with regard to guns and the usage of guns, were there?
And just take a step further about from the armories. If there were armories, there were also lists of militiamen, right? Mm-hmm. So the authorities knew who was in the militia and therefore who had guns and what kind of guns they had. So when you hear today people resist the idea of any kind of registry of firearms, well, they had it in the colonies on a local level. It's always been with us, some kind of regulation has.
So we go from this history to the Revolutionary War is successful. We're trying to form a country. We have the Articles of Confederation. That government's too weak, so we're starting to write the Constitution. This is where the Second Amendment obviously comes in. How did that all develop? What's the...
Well, nowadays it's become fashionable among people who support gun rights strongly to pick out this or that quotation from this or that leader like Samuel Adams or Thomas Jefferson or whoever, and imply that the Second Amendment is basically seen as a way to enable individuals to defend themselves and defend themselves against the government when it became tyrannical. Well, that's a misunderstanding. It was a political matter, the Second Amendment. It was part of what became the Bill of Rights. And the reason for it is that after the unhappy experience of the Articles of Confederation led the founders to try to figure out a better way of governing this country, they came up with the Constitution, which, as we know, is full of checks and balances. But as it was submitted to the states for ratification, it became clear that they might not get the nine states they needed, unless there were promises of still more controls over the potential for the federal government overstepping its powers and crushing the states, which was not the object. So the agreement was to come up with a set of amendments to it, and make that the first order of business when Congress convened. Well, with that promise, they did get the nine states to ratify, and it went into effect, and Congress met, and indeed the first thing they started discussing was amendments. And to make a long story short, instead of sprinkling them into this or that provision of the Articles of the Constitution, they ended up with the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments in the list, and the Second Amendment was one of them. But the wording of it indicates it didn't create anything new. It simply recognized the right that already was there and connected it with the political reason for it, which was to ensure that the states could keep their militias, even if the federal government had a standing army, which everybody at the time thought would be the worst idea possible. That could lead to tyranny. And this was seen as a check against that kind of tyranny, a deterrent, if you will, to a tyrannical federal leader who could try to take over the country.
So was there any discussion of self-defense or running?
Very little. I mean, and the amendment itself doesn't say anything about self-defense. It simply says any well-regulated militia being necessary to the defense of a free state, the right, in other words, the existing right already, shall not be infringed.
A lot of arguments over the years. That with that, in terms of the tyrannical government, what did the founders seem to be thinking of? King George again, or something?
Well, of course, they were coming out of the experience of the war against the British, so obviously the attempt to impose tyranny with the British army was in their minds. But they'd been through the few years of the Confederation.
Had a little bit of a rebellion up in Massachusetts.
They did, and they had some trouble getting troops to answer the call to go fight.
Mm-hmm.
And so they thought, you'll see their quotations, especially from John Adams, who makes it clear they were not trying to create a situation where individuals who didn't like the federal government could go hole up with an arsenal somewhere, hold off the feds when they came.
People talk that way today.
And they do, but that's not the way those guys, the founders, saw it. They saw this strictly as a means of preserving the state's abilities to keep their militias going and in place. And John Adams says at one point, that the militia is always subservient to the state. It's not a rebellious institution.
It's well regulated. It's something that ties into the governmental setup. Even after the Constitution's adopted and Washington's in office, you've got the whiskey tax and the whiskey rebellion. How did they respond to that?
That went better than Shays' rebellion did. But sure. They recognized that they needed a strong federal power, that needed to be these checks that would ensure that the states kept powers as well.
Mm-hmm. Over time, then, during the 1800s, the rest of the 1800s, 1900s continue to have guns play a role in society, particularly on the frontier. Any surprises that you found studying that era?
Well, the main surprise to me was that gun control in the Wild West. I grew up with Western in the 50s and plenty of guns there. And in reality, you couldn't carry a gun around in a town like Dodge City is a good example. There were laws against that. You have to deposit your arms. If you were a cowboy who came in from the plains, there was a place where you were supposed to go store your pistol if you had one.
That doesn't fit with the way most people think about it.
No, but this is, of course, in settlements, not out in the wild prairie. But, they they're like towns everywhere today. You need a little law and order in town, and it's hard to keep that up if everybody's going around pulling out a pistol.
I mean, even the shootout at OK Corral was a gun control issue.
It started because Ike Clampett, I think it was, had been arrested or accused of violating the local ordinance that forbade carrying a firearm openly around town. Incidentally, the understanding of what gun rights were for, of course, began to evolve in the 19th century, and in particular in the South. In the early 19th century, there was a big problem with duels between gentlemen. Well, obviously, the most famous one is Aaron Burr and
Alexander Hamilton.
But dueling was fairly common, but it was frowned upon, and it could be prosecuted. And, Burr had to keep moving around to avoid being prosecuted.
Vice President Burr, actually.
Yeah, the Vice President. And but one of the means that people who insisted on being able to settle matters of honor on the spot started to do in the early 19th century was carry pistols, small ones, concealed. Well, this was seen by gentlemen as cowardly. You know, if you're going to be a man, then wear your pistol on your hip and don't sneakily carry it around inside your coat. So, that began to change.
And it's actually, still holds true today. Most places don't have any restrictions on open carrying of guns, which people don't realize, but there are places that do have restrictions on concealed carrying of guns.
Fewer and fewer.
Right. But it goes back to sort of that historical sense that the coward sneak was the guy with the concealed gun, whereas if you were openly having it in your holster, you could see what was coming.
You came up upon somebody. Yeah, a state like Vermont, for instance, has no rules practically at all about that.
Then you had the slave issue.
Slaves were also, before the Civil War, forbidden to have their guns. And whites in the South, some of them began to see personal firearms as a means of defending themselves against slave rebellions if they needed to. Later on, as we approached the Civil War and abolition became a strong movement, the abolitionists wanted to provide guns to the supporters of no slavery in Kansas and vice versa. So they wanted to supply arms to their abolitionists in Kansas so they could defend themselves against attacks by their opponents. After the war, the Ku Klux Klan and groups like that arose, and they were persecuting freed blacks in the South. And the blacks began to look for ways to defend themselves. The federal government tried to institute new state militias in some of the southern states, and whites wouldn't serve in them. Blacks saw them as a way of self-defense.
Certainly guns have played a role in a lot of our history. What was the legal understanding of those times? When there were restrictions, did folks consider that unconstitutional, or was that just a political battle that we fought out, whether it's an urban area or a city city on the frontier that's trying to get its act together?
Oddly, the courts didn't have much to say about gun rights except in state courts, where, for the most part, the early rulings by state and lower federal courts supported the right and saw it as not a right that belonged to criminals or to be used for criminal purposes, but more as a right that was in connection with civic duty. But the Supreme Court didn't say anything about the Second Amendment for about a century. They mentioned it briefly in a ruling in 1876, and that was U.S. versus Cruikshank, which arose out of a horrible massacre, one of the worst in the Reconstruction period, where a whole hundred or more blacks had tried to defend themselves in Louisiana and were attacked by a white crowd, and the federal government attempted to prosecute the attackers on the grounds that they had deprived the blacks who were killed of their Fourteenth Amendment type issue. And the Supreme Court didn't find that that was the case. It said at that time, you know, we don't see that there was any racial motivation at all here to deprive blacks of their rights specifically. And they, in a kind of aside, ruling said that the right to keep and bear arms in the Second Amendment was not a right granted by the Constitution. It was a pre-existing right. And so if there was any application, courts later extended from that to say that if it applied to anybody, it was to the federal government. So it's simply a limitation on the federal government's ability to tell certain classes.
And that's really how most of the Bill of Rights was interpreted by the courts, that, that it only applied to the federal government unless it was specifically incorporated to the states.
And we didn't get the incorporation to the states on the Second Amendment, of course, until 2010, the follow-up decision to
the Chicago case.
Right, the Chicago case.
How about in the 1900s, then? We've got, you know, you got the Prohibition era, you've got John Dillinger,
Prohibition.
The machine guns. What's up?
Prohibition produced organized crime and you know, G-men and Elliot Ness and all of that. And actually, the first real federal gun control measure that came into effect was as a result of that.
1934 firearms.
Exactly. And that was upheld in 1939 by the Supreme Court.
The Miller case,
where somebody had challenged the application of how could you be denied the right to have a machine gun, and the Supreme Court said, unless you can demonstrate that there's a relationship between having a machine gun in private hands and the preservation of a well-regulated militia, doesn't seem to have any application. That ruling was long interpreted to mean that the Supreme Court thought that there was no individual right to have firearms, that you had to be in some kind of a relationship to a militia, or the militia, or the National Guard, or whatever, or the military, to exercise your right to have firearms.
1938 is a long time ago, and that was the law of the land, clearly, until 2008. What changed during that time period?
Well, incidentally, the 1934 Firearms Act is still in force, but what changed?
Actually, just as an aside, I've always pointed that out. That shows how gun control can work. You don't see many bank robberies with machine guns anymore.
No.
They haven't banned machine guns, but there are serious restrictions on them, and that,
all
that seems to work.
All our horrible, appalling gun massacres are, none of them has been committed with a fully automatic weapon. But what happened? Well, you had the Firearms Act, and then, importantly, the 1960s happened, and all the racial and social turbulence of the 60s and the assassinations of President Kennedy, his brother, Martin Luther King, eventually produced another Gun Control Act, the 1968 Gun Control Act. There was support for that then, even in the leadership of the NRA at the time. And Charlton Heston even subscribed to a statement that was read by another Hollywood tough guy calling for some kind of regulation to prevent this the repetition of these crimes as horrible as these assassinations. But I think it's like with a lot of gun control measures. You support them. In California, Ronald Reagan supported a gun control measure because Black Panthers were running around with guns in the state legislature in Sacramento.
Hopefully carrying the gun.
Right.
And in the pictures for you and everything.
A law that made it harder, impossible to do that, and imposed a waiting period on the time you needed between applying for a handgun and actually being able to buy it. And people say, oh, well, that law will certainly stop the Black Panthers, but that law doesn't apply just to Black Panthers. It applies to everybody. Well, eventually you get a backlash. And, well, you know, there was a social and political backlash in general to a lot of the things that happened in the 60s. And I think gun control was one of them. So
But the 68 Act, I mean, that dealt mainly with the list of prohibited purchasers, right?
Right.
I mean, it wasn't saying that if you're a felon or a habitual drug user, dishonorably discharged, mentally dangerous, they use different terminology, but they went through a list of about eight or nine sections
right.
of people that shouldn't be able to buy guns. So.
But at the time, it was... it took a long time to do those checks, and eventually that was replaced by the system we have now, which is fully automated, and the FBI runs the National Instant Check System.
Actually, the way it worked is for the 25-year period was, in effect, the honor system. You went in to buy a gun, and they said, Craig, are you a
right.
felon? Are you dangerously
right.
mentally ill? If you said no, you get to buy your gun.
The 68 Act would allow people to lie and get away with it, absolutely. And that wasn't changed until actually the Brady Act.
Right.
And that's when the NRCS eventually later came into
play. So the NRA, those supporting things, the 68 Act, you've got prominent Republicans supporting it. When did the NRA change, and how did that mindset become different here?
Interestingly, it came as a sort of a surprise to me, too, to learn that the NRA was originally founded by two former New York Times reporters.
Now I know the blame.
But what they were concerned about was being prepared for national defense, like the First World War, and making sure that we had enough people in the country who knew how to use firearms, that we wouldn't be defeated if it came to a war.
When I was growing up, I got my NRA marksmanship badges at YMCA camp.
And I got one at summer camp 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I kept those badges, too. I was sort of quite a pride, and that was
right.
a different NRA.
And well, the NRA still does a lot of, I think, worthwhile training and certifying of ability to use firearms safely. But they became, politically, the leadership that had approved the 68 Gun Control Act was overthrown, replaced by others, and eventually by Charlton Heston became a spokesman for that faction. And now we have, Wayne LaPierre firmly in the saddle, and politically it's a very different organization from what it was in 1968, very clearly. It's also been able to raise huge amounts of money and become maybe the most powerful lobby here in Washington. And it plays basically on the backlash, on people's fears of, if crime is rising and the police can't do anything about it, then how are we going to keep ourselves from being robbed, murdered, raped, and so on? We need firearms to defend ourselves, and the NRA certainly has been playing on that line for many years.
But as crime was rising in the 80s and early 90s, crack cocaine and the gangs and more sophisticated guns, Congress acted again. I mean, really only the third time they acted to do a gun control type measure.
With the assault.
With the Brady Bill and the assault weapon ban. How does that fit into the chronology?
Well, you had the attempted assassination of President Reagan. It took him 10 years to come around to supporting a stronger measure. He eventually did, of course, the Brady Bill. And he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, which I'm sure everybody in the NRA has forgotten about, but I dug it up and it's in the book, saying that, if we need some kind of measure like the one I signed when I was governor of California that makes people go through a waiting period before they can acquire handguns. And I think the assault weapons ban, which came out a little later
next year,
was more emotional than real. If you look at violent crime committed with guns in our cities today or then, these assault weapons that look like M16s or AK-47s did not figure in those importantly. Those are mostly handguns, illegal handguns or pistols.
Saturday night specials from the 60s.
Exactly. But assault weapons look scary, and I think, they're easy to scare people about. They have figured, of course, disproportionately in these gun massacres like Aurora and others, but even many of them are just committed with semi-automatic pistols and long, large capacity magazines, which was part of the assault weapons ban, was to limit.
A lot of people probably don't understand the difference between a semi-automatic, a fully automatic, and maybe just a regular single-shot pistol.
Right. A revolver, you pull the trigger, and each time it fires a bullet, and one comes into the chamber, and you're ready to fire again. Same with a semi-automatic pistol. Semi-automatic assault weapon means you have to squeeze the trigger each time to fire.
Can really
you can
trigger
squeeze
a
fast
twist type thing. You can get
you can squeeze fast.
You get 30 rounds off,
but you can't go. You can't go the way
with a fully automatic. You just hold it back and keep firing.
Right.
This you have to twitch.
Right. But if you have a magazine with 100 rounds in it, the way they're shooting in the Aurora massacre did the movie theater Batman episode,
you can get a lot of.
He didn't get a lot of, although his magazine jammed, so he couldn't get off all 100 rounds. But
like the Tucson shooter with Gabby Gifford, that was a magazine that held 31 rounds, and he got those off in 15 seconds probably.
And then he was prevented from
when
reloading.
He went to reload.
And so I'm not.
So we had Brady Bill, we had assault weapon ban,
and it was allowed to last.
And 10 years later, right.
When the momentum behind keeping the ban ran out, and President Bush was in office. And,
instead of Bill Clinton.
Instead of Bill Clinton. So we had it. Now, there may be some move to rethink it. I found in doing research on the book that violent gun crime did not go down significantly during the period when the automatic weapons ban, the assault weapons ban, was in effect. That doesn't prove that it had no effect, but, statistically, it's
not. And there are arguments about that. I mean, part of it, I know, is that people...
We're going to have to shut it off there. It's a very interesting discussion, I think, that Mr. Craig Whitney provides, and seems like he's historically accurate in most all of what he says. And he passes on information and enlightens people that don't know our history about guns and gun possession and gun use in the United States. I was just reading, I don't have time to comment, of course, because the show's over, but about more people were killed last year with hammers and clubs than they were with rifles. Yet all this restriction is going to be done on rifles, et cetera, on and on and on. It's a long, long discussion. We'll be hearing a lot about it here in 2013. Folks, that's it for tonight, and we're going to ask Vera Lynn to sign off with her wonderful number, We'll Meet Again.
We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.